This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Bernardo Batislazo for New Books Network. And as our guest today, we have James Besson, an economist and technologist who serves as executive director of the Technology and Policy Research Initiative at Boston University School of Law. He has also been a successful innovator and CEO of a software company. James Besson studies the major economic impacts of technology on society, writing academic papers, magazine articles, and books. You can find a link to his profile in the New York Times in the show notes. His latest book, The New Goliath, argues that major firms' investments in proprietary software systems have allowed them to increase their dominance of industries, slowing aggregate innovation and raising income inequality. Earlier work with Michael Mauer on patents identified the social cost of poorly defined property rights. And this book, it was called Patent Failure by Princeton University Press, published in 2008. And as well as work on automation, such as learning by doing Yale University Press in 2015. Both historical and current, current information to provide a distinct analysis of the effects of employment, skills, and wage inequality. Besson's work has been widely cited in the press, as well as by U.S. White House, the Supreme Court, the European Parliament, and the Federal Trade Commission. So, James Besson, thank you very much for being with us, and welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you. As it's usual in our interviews, we would first ask you to tell us a little bit about you, although we've read a little bit of a bio, but we would like to hear in your words, who is James Besson and how did you become an academic?
So I have a very unusual career path. I studied economics at Harvard, but at some point I decided to go out into the real world. I ended up founding a newspaper and developing what turned out to be one of the first desktop publishing programs, software programs. This was in the early 1980s. Grew that. It became a successful company. We sold the company. The whole time I was running the software company, though, I was thinking about the economics questions and about how different things seem from what I had learned in the classroom. Very often the economists, particularly at the time I studied, had a very idealistic view about how technology changes things. So there were a series of questions that I wanted to research. I got back in contact with my college roommate, Eric Maskin, who had really gotten me interested in economics in the first place and has since had an illustrious career. He's at Harvard now. He's a Nobel laureate. But he graciously took me in and started working with me. We did some research together. We wrote a paper about software patents. And that sort of got me launched into doing academic work. I wanted to research these questions, and that's what I've done.
Thank you. But then it is also strikes me as an economist, how did you end up in a law department? And because
Yeah. So a lot of my early work, because of the paper with Maskin, was about patents. I teamed up with Mike Moyer at the law school and others, and we had a whole series of papers about patents. I think economists were just, I think they were sort of a new generation of economists who had a very idealistic view of patents and how well they worked. Older economists like Mike Scherer were rather more skeptical about patents. But particularly with coming from the software industry, there's been a lot of skepticism about the role of patents because, you know, here's this industry which became very innovative, largely without patents. And we then had patents introduced in the mid-90s in large form, in large numbers. And the result is certainly mixed. You know, part of this has spawned patent trolls and a lot of, things that work against innovation. So there was a lot of room to sort of explore where patents work well, where they don't work so well, what policies happen. And this was very policy oriented. It made sense to be in a law school, but it was sort of happenstance. We built on that. And so the organization I now run continues to study patents and IP, intellectual property, both from an economic point of view and a legal scholarship point of view. But we also look at a couple other big questions. One is the impact of technology on the workforce, things like automation. Is AI going to take over all our jobs? Things like that. The other is industry dynamism, which is what this book is really related to. Does technology affect industry dynamism, and how much is industry dynamism important for innovation? And then the fourth area is access to medicines and medical treatments.
Right. It seems more economics than law in a way, but then it depends how you look at it and the rights that people would give and how they manage those rights. So let me ask you a question while thinking of early career researchers. And that is, how did you secure your first book contract as you had already published with good prestigious academic publishers such as Princeton and Yale? So one would understand that this recent contract is because you already had experience working with Yale University Press. But
right.
If you're talking to an early career researcher, how or what advice would you give them in how to go and secure that first book contract?
Right. So it more came to me than me coming to it. I think the key thing was probably I had been publishing a number of working papers that seemed to be of interest. There was a lot of controversy about patents at the time. And it caught the attention of Tim Sullivan, who was an editor at Princeton. He's now moved on to other things, but he started talking to me, I think well before we actually had a specific idea for a book, but he sort of nurtured the contact. And I think many of the better editors will be out there looking for people who are writing things that may have some broader appeal than the specific economic niche they're working in. And, you know, they'll cultivate those relationships, and eventually there's an opportunity for a book there.
Thank you for that. I'm sure it will be helpful. Now, going back to New Goliath, what sort of story did you want it to tell?
Well, the book started, maybe I'll answer a slightly different question. So the book started about 5 years ago when I started looking at whether software might be related to the growing concentration of industries, the growing, you know, the dominance of large firms within their industries. There had been a flurry of some research and some popular press about how industries were becoming more dominated. Much of this was not done within the strict IO competition policy framework, but was looking more generally. I knew on the one hand that there was good evidence that firms were able to use software systems to increase their sales. And we also know there's a great inequality in how much firms invest in software. You know, there's some that invest billions, most invest zero or close to it. So I knew there had to be some effect of software on industry concentration because it was happening in the time period that we saw the data for concentration increasing. So I looked, I found a relationship. I used some instrumental variables, and the relationship seemed to be A, plausibly causal, and B, it was of a magnitude large enough to explain much, if not most, of the growth in industry dominance. So this started me thinking, and it brought up something that I've been aware of since my years in business, which when we were doing desktop publishing systems for large retailers or catalogs, it was very clear that these firms, even back in the 80s, were using data to try to target what they were selling to different people. We built a system for the A&P supermarket chain, which allowed them to tailor the circular ads for different neighborhoods so that they would have different things on sale in one neighborhood of Atlanta and then from another neighborhood. You know, and there were maybe two dozen or so different circulars going on, all targeting the ads and the special sale items. So I wrote about that at the time in the Harvard Business Review. It was a pretty interesting development. People tied it to mass customization and, you know, this perennial need to meet customers' individual or idiosyncratic needs. And I was well aware that it had been going on for some time. But when I started, this ended up sort of being the second element that gelled my perspective of what was going on. Because when I saw this relationship between software and industry concentration, and then I said, well, what's going on here? Why is this happening? And when I started looking into case studies, the common thread I saw is that these firms are building these very large, very complex, data-intensive systems to enable them to manage complexity so as to better meet idiosyncratic consumer needs. So it may be, automobiles or software programs that have many, many features. It may be a huge increase in product variety. So, you know, back in 1970, there were 5 sports shoes on the market, and now there's something like 3,000. So the nature of competition is changing in a way, and these firms are using software to manage these complex systems. So it's things like Walmart has these logistics. It's able to, number one, stock many more items in their stores and also stock them very efficiently, very quick logistics, very, very able to respond very quickly to changes in consumer demand. And at the same time, they build an organization around that. So it's not traditionally retailers would have buyers who would make centralized purchasing decisions, and that would be it for the entire chain. Here, they open things up so that store managers or even their suppliers could initiate reorders of goods that were selling rapidly to keep things well stocked on the shelves that were hot items. And so you have people selling, firms selling more variety, different variety, more features, and all of this becomes very complex, but software is very good at managing complexity. So that seemed to be the common theme. And those two elements together is sort of what created the idea of the book. So I followed a line of research. We're still following that line of research. I think there's a lot more, fertile ground to explore here. But that's sort of the genesis.
Exactly. And one of the things that I found very interesting in the book is how you also make this effort to make people think it's not only about software on the supply side and diminishing cost, but on the demand side and what impact that has. And when you were talking about it just now, it reminded me of an effect, or part of the effect that this has, that I'm not sure if you mentioned it, which is that it makes search costs for consumers much more expensive. And that's a big issue, especially for a number of industries, but certainly for financial services, which is my kind of more where I'm inclined, because then regulators, which are thinking that consumers are going to be able to go and search for the best alternative, lose those incentives. They searching for when you have 500 mortgage contracts. It's impossible for an individual to go and evaluate which is the best alternative for him, her, or their family unit, and it has very important implications not only for the individuals, but also for regulation and who do they protect, and how do they protect, because the reaction for the consumer, and that was something that. When I did a little bit of work for the UK government some time ago, was that the consumer's reaction is, I'm going to choose whatever it's available, whatever I perceive to be the first option, because I know that I'm going to be saved. Eventually, the government is going to come in and save me. And so it creates all of these perverse incentives for this. But let me not unpack your story for you.
No. Actually, I think that's a really interesting example. And I want to draw two other things out of it, if you don't mind. This is actually one of the areas that we're exploring a little more deeply now that the book is out. But one is the consumers may not even, you talk about the mortgages or whatever, they may not even understand what all these different features are in the mortgages. So it makes it even worse. But second, this introduces, it's not only that search is costly, it's that there are search frictions, which changes the dynamics of competition so that incumbents have an inherent advantage. If I have a mortgage from one company, it seems to have worked, I stick with it. Somebody may come along, an innovator, with a much better idea, a much better risk profile for me, a much lower interest rate, and I'm not going to switch to them because I'm just too confused by the whole damn thing. So that's part of what goes on here. It slows things. It slows the growth of innovators down, and that was one of the findings I do talk about in the book. So I'm sorry, I interrupted your question.
No, it's okay. It was coming back to that, but let's take just a slight step backwards and try to take your views in two or three important things that you do touch on. And one of them is your view on the so-called Solow paradox. And for those who are not familiar with it, is this statement by Robert Solow, who famously during his Nobel Prize speech said something along the lines that the computer age was everywhere except in the productivity statistics. So either the productivity statistics were wrong, or the computer age was not having the impact that everybody kind of saw. And that created a flurry of research and discussion around it. So how would this work that you're coming back with would address this apparent paradox?
Right. So, I mean, I think the history of the solar paradox is that shortly after he made that statement, productivity started going up. Productivity growth went up for a decade or so. And it was strongly tied to computers. But I think there's, it may be helpful to sort of broaden the view. It wasn't just that this new game, you know, the idea that these low-cost computers would boost productivity, but it was sort of they were going to democratize innovation. They made it possible for lots of small firms to buy a PC, personal computer, cheap software on it that was comparable to what the mainframes were running, and they could do tremendous things. So in my business, desktop publishing, we found all sorts of new publishers came along because they could now produce their pages much more cost effectively. And so you saw the number of weekly newspapers go up and you saw the number of magazines go up for a while until the internet came along. And you saw this in a whole bunch of different areas where, you know, retail stores could get barcoding and they actually, smaller chains tended to pioneer this technology rather than the big chains. They could actually, you know, have this technology at their fingertips. What's happened is the role of computers and the role of software has flipped things. So now with these large systems, it becomes almost impossible for a small retailer to compete against Walmart. It's very difficult. And you see lots of small retailers going out of business, even ones that are very innovative in their niche markets or whatever. It just becomes very difficult if you're, you know, just down the street from a store that carries 100,000 different items at low prices. So it's, on the one hand, it's flipped things around in terms of making, you know, software rather than disrupting the incumbents, which it was doing early on, is now helping the incumbents suppress disruption. And that has impacts on productivity. So the key impact, I think one of the, everybody worries about the, you know, sort of the entry of startups. And it turns out that we're creating just about as many startups today as we did 20 years ago. But the difference is the startups are growing much more slowly. And that slow growth is in many industries related to these dominant systems that make it difficult for smaller firms to grow. So researchers at the Census have tied the slower growth of startups, innovative startups, as a key cause of the slowdown in productivity growth. So that's what's one of the key concerns of the book is that when you have that happening, it's almost the reverse of the solo paradox. Computers are everywhere and they're having a negative effect on aggregate productivity growth. Some firms are doing very well with them, but most firms simply cannot access the technology. And that creates a big and important difference.
Exactly. And in that response, you've basically defined what you understand by complexity in this context. And you have briefly explain, you know, why disruptive innovation in a way is a myth, because we don't see any of that. And also addressed this, you or provided an explanation, which is what is also driving the book as this reduction in productivity in the US economy. Now, would that be something that we would also expect to see in other countries, a reduction in productivity tied to this complexity in IT systems?
So I believe the OECD researchers have found some similar patterns in other developed countries, but where, you know, digital technology has played a role in the increased dominance of the major firms, the growing concentration. I'm not sure they've connected it to the productivity slowdown in the same way. There's a series of papers that John Halterwanger and co-authors using U.S. Census data that I have established that component very well. But I'm not aware of the same thing being established in European countries. There may be some research there that I don't know.
Partly the question was driven not only, I mean, was driven because of you pointing to the use of technology, but at the same time, the US is a major producer of both hardware and software. Maybe not the manufacturing, which has gone to China, but it is the cradle of a number of these innovation and these uses that are then spread out. So in the sense of other countries being followers in that sense, you know, that was a little bit where the question was going.
Yeah, so there's a study that looked at UK firms and found out that US multinationals were able to use their IT much more effectively in Britain than the British national, you know, after controlling for all sorts of things. And I think they attribute it to US management methods and sort of skills and understanding about IT, information technology.
Okay. So the book is basically written in a very open language. For a wide audience, it's very easy to go through it. Nonetheless, there is an empirical base for it. So would you like to tell us a little bit of what data did you use and how and why you chose this data?
Okay. So the book really draws on a lot of different data and different sources. Some of it we did, but we're also drawing on the work of lots of other people, which I think either complement or contribute in important ways. So I wouldn't want to underemphasize that. We used a variety of data sources for various points in the book, but you know, looking at using data from the U.S. Census, data from things like CompuStat, you know, the data on publicly listed firms. We have data on job advertisements. We're able to use that, help wanted ads, use that to identify important changes in demands for skills and pay. So it's really, you know, a sort of a broad range of different data sources for various studies. And so there's a series, I don't know, a half dozen or so different papers, some published, some not. Some historical data, even, I think we looked at, at least
exactly.
Going back.
And I was actually, sorry.
Go on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, I was exactly going to ask you, you know, something that I've always picked up from your work is this combination of new sources to sometimes historical to explore difficult things that other statistics would make it. I mean, in this case is, you know, how do you measure intangibles and how do you measure software, which is very, very hard from a straightforward statistics perspective. And you're finding, you know, in a very creative way, these alternative sources, as you said, you know, job adverts or the number of, in other of your pieces, the number of tellers at the bank branches to measure the impact of ATMs. And so would you, you know, this combination of historical data and econometrics, would you like to care to explore or this, you know, tell us a little bit more about this?
Well, it comes in a couple of different ways and a couple of different flavors. I mean, one is, I think when you look at historical data, sometimes you're challenged to be more creative with what you can extract out of data. So that's where we come up with some of the ideas of, you know, we could measure software developer at a firm by looking at the number of software developers it hires or the number of software developers it's advertising to hire. One of the best uses of history is to sort of help us understand the bigger picture in a way. So this is one of the themes, I think, that we're looking at a change in the relationship between technology and society. Most of the time we have technology coming along, and what does it do? It improves productivity in some way, but it doesn't change fundamental economic relationships. And I think many economists are very content with that. But I think you have to recognize that there are times when a new technology or group of technologies does really change things. So one of those occurred in the late 19th century, where we had the introduction of a number of technologies where there were big economies of scale, steel and petroleum and sugar manufacturing. This really changed the nature of the economy. It meant that you had a rise of big firms. It brought in financial capital to make those big firms even bigger. Think of U.S. Steel. It changed. It clearly created, created the modern antitrust scheme. It created a reaction where people wanted to control these very large and powerful firms. But it was a somewhat different economics, the idea of producing things at scale. And I think we're seeing a similar change in the relationship, because now we're seeing these systems come along that are able to address heterogeneous consumer needs in a very different way. And like we were talking before, it changes the nature of competition. It changes the nature of how innovation gets done, about how innovation and new ideas spread through the economy. So, one of the aspects of this new arrangement is that, for a couple reasons, and I can go into them if we want, but the ideas aren't spreading as rapidly as they have in the past. I give the example of the automatic transmission came along, General Motors developed it, and within 10 years, all of its rivals had automatic transmissions in a variety of different ways, but that happened. Today, we're seeing what some people at the OECD identified as a productivity gap. We're seeing, there are some firms that have developed this very productive technology, but the gap between them and most of the other firms has been growing over the last 20 years, something that's new. And it's a sign that technology isn't diffusing as fast as it did in the past.
If I may, I don't know if I'm making a correct reinterpretation of what you're saying, but in a way, what you're describing is this move from an economy where we saw economies of scale, that is, constant reduction of average cost of production, being something that was odd, and really textbooks would push it to something that happened in utilities, and that was not the main discussion. Whereas now with software and with software or computer technology being central to production, economies of scale are central to most industries and to production in general, and therefore, we need to question if we have the right tools to be able to deal with this conceptually as economists, and it's perhaps something that I'm borrowing from the work of Diane Doyle, who has also written on the limits of current regulation. And whether economic thinking is suited for this new industry environment, and whether large you know, whether regulation is able to deal with and antitrust, as you have mentioned, with these large software-intensive companies. And it's something that you also address in the book. So would you give us a little bit of more of your thought on this?
Yeah, so one is I want to preface this by saying I don't think I know all the answers, but absolutely I think we're dealing with a world that's different and regulation is different. So these are there is a scale economy to software of a sort, but it's a different scale economy than an electric plant. You know, the electric plant is a minimum efficient size. That meant that in smaller markets, one plant was a natural monopoly. The same thing isn't going on here. There's no minimum efficient size in terms of these software systems. What these systems do is, in a sense, they are reducing diseconomies of scope. So it's a different problem from a regulatory perspective. I think the key is the problems that I identify related to these systems. First, I should premise and say these systems are great. They're a wonderful benefit. They allow us as consumers to receive a much better selection of goods that we want, to have goods that are very well tailored to our needs. The difficulties arise because there's only a few companies that have this technology, and they become very dominant, and ideally we want to see the technology spread. It's the same story with any technology, but like I was saying, the diffusion of the technology is much slower today. So we want to think about ways that, in terms of looking at regulation and policy, we want to think about ways to encourage firms to open up in some way, to share pieces of their technology, perhaps for a fee. And we have some examples of companies that are doing that on their own. So Amazon has done this in a number of different areas, but one is the cloud. In the mid-2000s, Amazon realized they had developed a unique competitive advantage. They could manage, you know, their huge website traffic in a very efficient way. It turns out this is a very difficult IT problem to solve. They solved it. They had this tremendous advantage. And rather than keep it as a proprietary advantage, they unbundled it. They created Amazon Web Services, the first cloud, so that anybody could, for a fee, tap into their tremendous resources. And it could be a two-person company, or it could be a 200,000-person company, or it could be a two-person company that grows to a 200,000 person company, you know, is all very scalable, very adaptable. And it's, you know, one, it means that there's tremendous competition now in some of these areas and some markets that would otherwise not be there. Two, there's some studies showing that there are definite productivity effects for small firms using the cloud. And three, it's been hugely profitable for Amazon. Of course, now Amazon has rivals. It's got, you know, Microsoft's in there and Google's in there. But, you know, they created the cloud industry by opening things up. Similarly, in the past, we've seen government to compel or encourage firms to open up, you know, making patent portfolios, licensing them is often a condition of merger. There are cases where the antitrust authorities have used compulsory licensing to, you know, to force companies to license, or they've encouraged them. They encourage AT&T to, or I guess as a part of a consent decree, AT&T was forced to license its semiconductor patents, and that essentially created the semiconductor industry. So these are tricky policy issues. It's not a clear-cut issue, because you don't want to, you know, you can very clearly undercut a firm's incentives to innovate in the first place if you're going to force it to give it away. On the other hand, in many cases, it appears to be the case that firms themselves don't even appreciate the profit potential they could get by opening up in some way, or the, you know, they haven't, there's also this, you know, externality that they're not incorporating, that they may be encouraged to incorporate. But it turned out, for instance, with IBM, that IBM was induced by the antitrust authorities to unbundle its software from its hardware. That turned out to be tremendously profitable for them. That created the modern independent software industry. IBM had looked at it doing it itself and couldn't make up its mind. It basically, even though this was something that turned out to be hugely profitable for them in the long run, it was hard for them to see. Anyway, so those are some of the policy issues that I think regulators need to address, but it's going to take us a while to figure out how to do this the right way.
I think you've given them the answer to the next question, which is there's no clear or single solution for all industries in all countries in how to address this from a antitrust perspective. However, you've just given clear examples where antitrust does work and does bring, you know, things, moves things forward. Let me get to, since we're in this topic, some people have criticized your book as being a great diagnostic of the problem, but not being more aggressive in terms of solutions and critical of the software industry. What would you respond to that?
Well, first off, it's not the software industry per se. It's, you know, this is really across the board. One of the things I'm at constant pains to emphasize about the book, the problems I see aren't just about big tech. Big tech's mainly a small part of the picture. This is, you know, the majority of major industries. We're talking about retail. We're talking about banking. We're talking about insurance. We're talking about pharmacy benefit managers. So it's not just the software industry. But I would agree and say I don't have all the answers in terms of the right policy. But by having a clear diagnosis, I can hopefully contribute to an ongoing discussion and analysis of what policies will work and which ones don't. A lot of these areas, another aspect of openness relates to things like employee mobility, another very fraught policy area. But there are things like non-compete agreements or trade secrecy, which are important and provide positive incentives to firms in some cases. But there's some evidence that the pendulum has swung too far in the other direction, and we're now preventing employees from changing jobs, where by doing so, they would help diffuse technical knowledge that really would be socially beneficial. Figuring out the right balance is tricky. So I don't have the answers. If I've done a good diagnosis, though, at least we're halfway towards understanding, what I think a difficult policy area.
Thank you. So there's always things that are left out in when putting a paper or a book or research. So what would be the interesting nuggets that did not make the final draft or themes that you, if you would have had the space, you would have included?
Yeah, so it's not space that limited me. I think it was just how far the thinking had gone. And so there's some areas where we're now pushing further or where the data analysis has gone. One of the things we're exploring, I mentioned earlier, is understanding how this sort of proliferation of product variety and product choices really affects the nature of interactions with consumers and consumer search, and what that means. That's one area we're further exploring. Another is, I think there's this great data out there from the census people about how the slowdown in the growth of innovative firms is responsible for a significant part of the aggregate slowdown in productivity growth. We have had done a little research, which I've put in the book, about factors that affect that the rate of growth of productive firms. We're seeing a bunch more research coming along that's addressing that, and I think that's going to be one of the key questions going forward.
Thanks. Well, James Besson, thank you very much for being with us at the New Books Network. For those who are listening, please, if you haven't done so, subscribe to our podcast. And if you're a subscriber, please rank us. You can also follow us in Twitter, in New Books, at New Books and New Books Network, as well as our sister channel in New Books in Spanish. Again, thank you very much for having us, and we look forward to having you again with your new book is out.
Thank you for having me.